You're listening to TheBody.com's podcast coverage of the 2008 ICAC-IDSA Joint Conference. The conference took place in Washington, D.C. from October 25th through October 28th, 2008.
Welcome. This is Bonnie Goldman, editorial director of TheBody.com. I'm here today with Dr. Joel Gallant. Dr. Gallant has been treating people with HIV since the beginning of the pandemic. He's also a leading HIV researcher and a professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. Welcome, Dr. Gallant.
Thanks, Bonnie. Good to be here.
So what research presented at this conference do you think will most dramatically change options for HIV-positive people?
There were a number of clinical trials related to initial therapy, the first regimen, that I think were really important at this meeting. Probably the most important one was the what's called the STARTMARC trial. And this was a big phase three trial comparing Isentris, which is the new integrase inhibitor from Merck, against Sustiva, both of those in combination with Truvada, for people who are on their first regimen. And we'd seen earlier studies, smaller studies, that suggested that Isentris was going to be as good as Sustiva and maybe better tolerated. This was the big trial with lots of patients enrolled, and it showed exactly that, both drugs did great, very high rates of suppression at 1 year, and to use a statistical term, Isentris was what we call non-inferior to Sustiva. But also, as you might expect, Isentris didn't cause the central nervous system side effects that we associate with Sustiva. So you didn't see the dizziness, the dreams, that kind of thing. So in that sense, Isentris was as good as Sustiva, but better tolerated. There are also some little bit of advantage in terms of triglycerides, but both of those drugs are pretty good in terms of their effect on lipids. So this trial, I think, brings the class of integrase inhibitors, and specifically Isentris, into the list of drugs that we could consider for first-line use. Now, the one disadvantage of Isentris is that it's a twice-a-day drug, and of course, Sustiva is usually given in combination with Truvada in the form of a single pill, a tripla, which you take once a day, and that's an enormous advantage, and people like that a lot. To take Isentris, you'd have to be taking twice-a-day regimen. On the other hand, for some people, the trade-off in terms of side effects may be worth taking a twice-a-day combination. They also presented some data looking at why Isentris might end up being a once-a-day drug. They're not there yet. They haven't studied it, but there at least is a scientific rationale for why this drug may be able to be given once a day, and they're going to proceed with studies comparing once and twice a day. So, you know, it may not be a twice-a-day drug forever, but I think this study was particularly important because up until this conference, the choices for initial therapy were 2 nukes plus a non-nuke like Sustiva or 2 nukes plus a protease inhibitor. Now we have a third option.
So do you think it's true what they've been saying that about Isentris, that it's one of the most powerful HIV medications we've ever seen?
I don't think we know that it's more powerful. It's certainly very effective, and it's very well tolerated. Those are the advantages. I don't think we can say that it is more powerful. You know, potency is a different issue than what we call effectiveness or efficacy. But the combination of being effective and being relatively free of side effects is really kind of the claim to fame. The other issue, of course, it's an entirely new class, so nobody's resistant to it yet if they haven't already taken it. And so for that reason, in treatment-experienced patients, it offered a lot because, you know, it was a drug that no matter how resistant you were to other drugs, you'd respond to this drug. And so that maybe that gave people the sense of power. But it's a great drug. And this moves it from a drug that was primarily for salvage into, you know, the first-line arena. Now, this wasn't the only trial for naive patients. I stressed it at first because it was really the most novel of the studies. But we also heard longer-term data on a number of other trials, such as the Artemis study, looking at once-a-day Prezista with Norvir versus Kaletra for first-line. And again, now at 2 years, Prezista is actually looking better than Kaletra for first-line therapy, both in terms of its effectiveness and also its tolerability. as well as its effect on lipids. And as many of you know, the FDA just approved Prezista now for once-a-day use in treatment-naive patients at a dose of 800 milligrams with 100 of Norvir, and the 400 milligram tablet has just become available and is in pharmacies. So this is certainly offers another option for people who haven't yet used PIs. And then we also heard more data from the CASEL study looking at Reataz and Norvir compared to Kaletra. And again, there looks like there's advantages of Reataz over Kaletra, specifically in terms of GI tolerability and effect on lipids. My own feeling is that both the Artemis and the CASEL study, what they're telling us is that if you have never been on a PI before, and you don't have any PI resistance, then you shouldn't have to take more than 100 milligrams of Norvir. The problem with Kaletra, as good as it is and as durable as it's been over the years, is that the only way you can take Kaletra is to be on 200 milligrams of Norvir. And when you're taking 200 milligrams of Norvir, you're going to have more diarrhea, more nausea, and more effect on your cholesterol and triglycerides. So I think the way we're moving in terms of protease inhibitors is to take the lowest amount of Norvir that you can get away with. And we're seeing from with Prezista, with Reataz, and also with Lexeva, that 100 milligrams of Norvir is just fine.
So the problem with Kaletra is it's contained. The Norvir is within the pill, so you can't take it out. So you're taking more than you need.
Exactly. I mean, that's also the advantage of Kaletra, of course, is that you don't need an extra pill, you don't need an extra copay, you don't need refrigeration. The Kaletra includes Norvir, but the disadvantage is you're stuck with that dose of 200 milligrams.
Uh-huh. So another question about integrating Ascentris into care. So far, everyone's pretty happy with the triple. I mean, it's good enough, and if it's not, there's Reataz. So, I mean, how many options do we need for first line that are really powerful?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I mean, a triple has still really never been beat. You could argue that Ascentris came close to beating a triple, not in terms of effectiveness, but just in terms of tolerability. But a triple, or at least Sestiva-based regimens, that especially those that include Viriad or Truvada, really are remain the gold standard. That we haven't seen those be better. So I think a triple is still going to be the first line regimen for most people. But keep in mind there are people who can't take this drug. So, for example, people who have a lot of the side effects, psychiatric and neurologic side effects, difficulty concentrating, mood changes, insomnia. Most of those things go away in a few days, but there are people where it goes on for weeks and weeks and they can't stay on it. There are people, women who want to become pregnant or who aren't preventing pregnancy, may not be good candidates for that. So there certainly are people who end up on something else, such as boosted Reataz, you mentioned, and I think now boosted Prezista is going to enter that realm too. And Ascentris may compete against the idea of always using a protease inhibitor as your backup when you can't use a triple. There will be some people, I suspect, who will simply hear about the side effects of the triple and say, I don't even want to even try it. I don't care if I take pills twice a day. I'd rather just go with something that is unlikely to cause side effects. Now that becomes a possibility. Then there's also, the question of what about people who can't take nucleosides? So a triple contains Truvada, and Truvada contains Viriad. Viriad is a drug that, rarely can cause kidney damage, but for people who already have kidney problems, this may be a concern. We are now having more and more concern about abacavir, which is an ingredient in Epsicum, and in terms of whether it's less effective at high viral loads, whether it could cause heart problems. And so there may be some people, for example, people who have a lot of risk factors for heart disease and kidney disease, who may be better off on no nukes at all. And now we have the option, for example, to use, you could use a protease inhibitor and Ascentris. You could use a protease inhibitor and Sestiva without using nucleosides at all. I don't think that'll be a common approach, but there may be people for whom it's appropriate.
Has that kind of regimen been studied, though?
Not in naive patients, but there certainly are now studies that are ongoing, looking especially at protease inhibitors plus Isentress. I think we'll see more of those, and we'll have more information. It also brings up the point that you can now go from a first-line regimen to a second-line regimen with no overlap in classes, meaning that, let's say you started a tripla and failed a tripla for some reason. That's not common, but it could happen. You could then go to a protease inhibitor and an integrase inhibitor where there'd be absolutely no concern about cross-resistance because you're using two entirely new classes of drugs in your second line, and you could just as easily flip the order where you started with the protease inhibitor and the integrase inhibitor and then went to something like a triplet. So we're really opening up a lot of options for how we can start, how we can sequence from one class to another.
So who's going to teach the physicians of America about this new treatment paradigm? It sounds like a sea change.
Well,
there's a lot of changes, meaning instead of, meaning what was true last year is not true this year. And it's hard to catch up and to you know, not do the same old thing because, you know, you have a practice and you're busy doing the same old thing. And so physicians don't necessarily adapt easily to new things. So what is a patient to do?
Well, fortunately, the things that were true last year are still true in the sense that, you know, a triple is still a great way to start. Truvada plus a boosted PI is still a great way to start. It's just that now we have this other option. So it opens up options. You know, I think that, of course, I've always said that people with HIV should either be managed by an expert or should their primary doctor should have regular consultation with an expert. You know, you shouldn't be doing this. This shouldn't be prescribed by somebody who's sort of dabbling with a few patients with HIV. It's another point, I think, why guidelines are so important. We recently had the IAS USA guidelines updated, and they're pretty current, although they're not going to reflect this Isentress data. And then you have the DHHS guidelines that get updated on a regular basis, and so that's another good way for doctors to keep up. And I would point out that those guidelines, you know, a lot of people think it's just a table, what to start, when to start. In fact, the guidelines provide a wonderful, detailed document. If you knew the material in those guidelines, you'd really be up to date, I think, on HIV. And so I think it's important not just to know the bottom line, but to study that document and make sure that you're keeping up in that way. Of course, there's lots of, you know, CME programs and a lot of courses and updates and things like that for people who can't come to these meetings.
Since you mentioned the guidelines, I wasn't going to bring it up, but you are on the guidelines committee. Do we have any idea when they'll be updated to reflect all these changes?
Well, the guidelines get updated when they're updated. You know, I mean, there's no regular schedule. It depends on, you know, how soon the group can come to agreement. And there's subcommittees that look at different aspects. So I couldn't predict except to say that all the data from ICAC will be considered by the panel.
Because there's so many things that happened since January 2008. It's, you know, amazing.
Well, you'll just have to interview me again when that time comes.
Okay. So let me see what else I have. Anything else that stood out for you at the conference?
Well, I think one of the most important studies from a treatment standpoint was this study from the NA Accord. NA Accord is this big conglomeration of a bunch of clinical cohorts, 22 different cohorts in Canada and the U.S., and so it represents a huge number of patients. And what they decided to look at was the question of when to start therapy. And they specifically took the cohort and they looked at people who started within a year and a half of their first CD4 between 350 and 500. And they compared those people with those who waited, who did not start within a year and a half of meeting that point. And what they found was that those who started early had a 70% better survival rate than those who waited. They even correcting for things like hepatitis C and injection drug use, still found the same thing. These same investigators are going to go further with this, and hopefully at the next meeting in CROI in February, and then they're going to look at those who started above 500 to see if they see the same effect. You know, there are problems with observational studies like this. On the other hand, you know, there's talk of this START study, which is going to be a trial that randomizes people to early versus delayed therapy. If that study happens at all, in the current budget climate. It's going to be a very expensive study. It could take years to get the results. And my concern is that by the time we get the results of that study, nobody's going to care because we'll have already moved on and we'll be treating much earlier based on big observational studies like NA-ACCORD. So my own feeling is that these observational studies, when done well, are extremely important for guiding these questions that are very hard to study in the traditional way where you randomize people to two different arms. So I think the study presented here has moved us further toward the idea of treating earlier at higher CD4 counts.
But in reality, what's the average T-cell count of somebody who walks into a clinic today?
I think in the U.S., the last I heard it was about 180. So for this average person we're talking about, this discussion is completely irrelevant because they needed to be started years before they even got diagnosed. I'm hoping that will change if states start to, and doctors start to follow the CDC recommendations saying that we should be testing everybody. That, you know, hasn't happened yet, and we don't know how we're going to pay for care or how we're going to find enough doctors for all these people if they do get tested. But for somebody out there who's not in that situation, who was diagnosed early, I think these questions are very relevant.
So if you have a patient who you've been seeing and it has a CD4 count of, let's say, 500 or something, has your mind been changed by anything you saw at this conference in terms of that trial? I mean, would you, if they said, what do you think, doc, should I start? Would you say now, yeah, you might want to?
I was saying that before. I think this study just gives me that much more evidence to really support that. I mean, my approach has been to quote the guidelines, and the guidelines currently say that you should start if your CD4 is below 350, and you should consider, and this is the part of the guidelines that a lot of doctors don't hear, the footnotes say, you should start if your CD4 is below 350, but if it's above 350, you should consider treating if you have hepatitis B, if you have HIV renal kidney disease, if you have a partner who's negative, if your viral load is high, if your CD4 is falling rapidly. All those are considerations that might make you want to start earlier. Now we have this study that suggests that there may be benefits for everybody to start earlier. And a lot of that is because of what we used to call non-HIV-related morbidity and mortality. You know, cancers, the heart disease, liver disease, these things that when they happened before in smaller studies, we would just say, oh, well, that has nothing to do with HIV. Now we're beginning to realize it probably does. It's not good for you to have virus in your blood. And my own approach in patients like that who have high CD4s is to tell them that while this is not standard of care yet, there's certainly a strong scientific rationale for treatment of almost everybody. And especially in the person who's likely to be adherent to therapy, who's motivated, who, you know, I wouldn't push them, but I would certainly suggest it. And if they ask me, what would you do, I would treat.
Is there any understanding of what the virus does to you that's so bad? I mean, has somebody been studying the exact mechanism that makes it so harmful to humans?
There's a lot of different hypotheses, and some of them have pretty good evidence. We know that untreated HIV increases inflammation in your body, and inflammation is the kind of thing that can result in myocardial infarction or heart attack, stroke, things like that. We know that HIV can increase your blood's ability to clot, which could also have to do with why people may develop more heart attacks when they're not treated. We're concerned about its effect on the brain, and will we see long-term problems with, you know, not so much dementia, because we're not seeing a lot of dementia, but just subtle differences in your ability, your cognitive abilities with untreated HIV. We're worried about, you know, the premature aging that may be caused by HIV, effect on bones, on metabolics. We know that untreated HIV can affect your lipids. So there's all sorts of mechanisms by which HIV may cause these less AIDS-specific problems.
So this kind of study kind of says that the tests we have, the CD4 count, the viral load, are not the only things that we should, you know, look at. Because people look at those and they say, okay, I'm well.
Right.
I have 500 T cells. My viral load is undetectable. And that's it. But they should also think, well, something else is going on. We're just not measuring it.
Yeah. Well, the CD4, we've always known the CD4 is great at predicting whether you're going to get PCP or MAC or CMV, you know. But we've moved on from that. You know, that we can prevent those things, and now, you know, we're realizing that CD4, it only measures those issues that are truly phenomena of immunosuppression, but it's not going to tell you what's going on in terms of inflammation and immune activation and ability to clot and all those things. Viral load may be a little bit more predictive. We know, for example, that the higher your viral load, the more inflammation, the more immune activation. So viral load may be telling us a little more, and it's certainly, if you're untreated, if you're not on treatment, it's probably better to have a low viral load than a high viral load. But it doesn't mean that there aren't things going on, even when your viral load is relatively low, that might be prevented by treatment.
So are there any studies that are ongoing now that are going to be so explosive? As you know, we had lots of new drugs last year, and now we have these two studies that were just presented about when to start and, you know, what to start with. Is there anything that we should look forward to in the next 6 months that's going to again change things? It's hard. It's like a roller coaster, and it's hard to keep up. And what do you think?
Yeah, well, I'm going to pull a Sarah Palin here. I'm going to answer a question that you didn't ask. I think one thing we need to realize is, and we saw this here at this conference, is that there aren't a lot of new drugs coming down the pipeline for people who have resistance. And, you know, we heard a little bit about Bevirimat, this maturation inhibitor. But frankly, late 2007, early 2008, we had this burst of new drugs that really revolutionized treatment for HIV. Now we're going to have this long dry spell with not much coming. And frankly, drug companies are very nervous right now about wanting to develop new drugs when everybody's got undetectable viral loads and they're not even sure, you know, how they would develop or sell these drugs. So I guess what I would say, rather than answering your question about what to look forward to, is what not to expect. And that is a steady supply of new drugs to bail us out when the old ones fail. So the reason I bring that up is just to emphasize how important it is to use these new drugs wisely to make sure that you're getting expert care, that if you have drug resistance, you're taking a combination of multiple active drugs. I'm really worried that a year or two from now, we'll be sitting and having a conversation about how to deal with integrase inhibitor resistance, isentress resistance, and that's going to be a big mess because we're not going to have much to help us there.
So adherence really counts now.
Oh, adherence really counts, yeah. Yeah, adherence always counted. But you know, the more effective a drug is, the more important it is to be adherent. Back in the days when we gave people AZT monotherapy, you know, being non-adherent to a drug that only worked a little bit probably wasn't that big of a deal. But now that these drugs are highly effective, but, you know, where resistance can occur, then adherence becomes really critical.
Okay, one last question. If you take your meds on time, every time, is it like, and you don't have a resistance walking in, you have a resistance test, is it, there are rumors that you could still get resistance somehow? Or is adherence really, really a matter?
Unless you started out with a transmitted, I mean, you, for example, let's take the Atripla example. There certainly are people who are infected with Sostiva-resistant virus. Now, most of the time, you're going to pick that up when you do your baseline resistance test. But you could miss that. It's possible, for example, if you, let's say you've been infected for 5 years and you finally got diagnosed, came into the doctor and got a resistance test and it didn't show any resistance, there is the possibility that there was a little bit of Sostiva resistance. It just wasn't at a high enough level to get picked up by the test. And then you take a Atripla and you could fail through no fault of your own. You're taking your meds. But what happened is you selected out that low-level resistance and it became the predominant strain. So that can happen. But if that isn't present, if you don't have baseline resistance, you put on a good regimen and you take it. And I would even add that with today's drugs, taking them on time isn't even that important. It's just taking them and not missing, you know, multiple doses is really what counts, because the timing is no longer as important as it used to be.
So being timing within 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, some of these drugs, you know, for example, a Atripla, if you, I'm not going to suggest this, but if you were to miss a day's worth or even 2 days worth, and you probably would be fine, because these drugs, they last
they
so long in the blood. Don't make a habit of that. But I'm just saying that unlike the old days with Crixivan, where you had to be right on the clock every 8 hours, you know, these new drugs just aren't really like that.
So they forgive a little
bit. They're quite forgiving. What they're not forgiving of is interrupting therapy. The worst thing you can do with a triplet, for example, is go away for a vacation for 2 weeks and forget to take your pills. Because that's where you get these long, you know, slowly declining drug levels, and we see a lot of resistance with that. But if people are taking it every day, I don't so much care when they take it. I just want, and the same is true for most of these protease inhibitors. If you get your drugs in every day, with food if that's required, that's really what counts. So anyway, back to your question though, I don't see resistance occurring for no reason. Everybody I've seen who fails therapy is either failing because they're not taking their meds, or they're failing because they had pre-existing resistance. Either it was resistance they were infected with, or resistance that occurred while on a previous regimen. People who are starting therapy from scratch with a normal resistance test, those people aren't failing. And I don't. And you know, Bob Silicano from Hopkins presented some data at this conference, just showing that when you're on, he used a triplet as an example, but I think it's true for any of the good regimens. When you're on a triplet and your viral load is undetectable, it's truly undetectable. There's really no evidence that the virus is replicating at all. And he showed that by adding additional drugs and not getting any further suppression, meaning that whatever virus you see, if you were able to measure it using an assay that got down to one copy, you might see a viral load of, say, 5 or 10, but that's not really replicating virus. It's just virus that's being released from reservoir cells. So if there's no replication, the virus isn't mutating, it's not developing resistance mutations, which means there's really no limit to how long one of these regimens could last. And while you may not stay on the same regimen forever because new drugs come out and things change, you wouldn't necessarily need to change because the regimen was failing.
Well, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, Bonnie.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebody.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
Thank you for listening to this report from the 2008 ICAC IDSA Joint Conference. For more coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebody.com/ICAAC2008.